Call the answer line where you're the head honcho, the big cheese, top dog, big man, mighty boss, and you can tell us exactly where to go.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, Radio Netherlands Weekly Communications Review with Jonathan Marks.
Hello, later on we'll give you a second and last chance to solve our mystery media quiz 89. But first, we're in a technical mood.
Radio Netherlands, like old times. Like others.
Today we have with us in the studio Newton Tweedsdale, art critic of the Onlooker.
Of course, Bonstad is always exciting, isn't it? Isn't it? And I'm bound to say that I enjoy the exhibition immensely.
Like heck.
Indeed, it's time for receiver update. We're still waiting for further news on the new ATS-808 portable receiver from the Sanjin Company of Taiwan. We're told it'll be another month at least before samples are available. Meanwhile, four projects to further the cause of international broadcasting have been given special credit this week, as Pete Myers now reports.
On Monday, the editorial office of the World Radio TV Handbook, based in Amsterdam, officially released details of its new annual award scheme. It seems they hope that these will act as a stimulus to receiver manufacturers. This year, awards were made in four categories.
The best communications receiver was judged to be the Kenwood R5000, combining all the functions needed for effortless tuning together with good quality audio.
The best portable receiver was the Sony ICF-7601. This is not a digital portable and has been overshadowed in the publicity by more expensive receivers, like the SW1S. This analog portable offers crisp reception, good performance for the price, and is ready for shortwave broadcast band expansions taking place this year. There are definitely not enough budget analog portables with good performance, hence the choice of this receiver.
The WRTH has also tested computer-related software. The most innovative software was judged to be Shortwave Navigator. This is a Macintosh computer program developed by Jim Frimmel, who lives in Texas. It's a computer card index, which gives the user access to schedules of many international broadcasters and their programs. But it was Frimmel's idea of recording some of the sounds heard on the air into the computer program that earned him the award.
Meanwhile, for those who use the IBM MS-DOS machine, or one of its 1,000 compatible clones, the best computer accessory of the past 12 months was certainly Shortwave Database. Tom Sundstrom of New Jersey deserves credit for his active promotion of the international radio listening field. His database of monitored schedules and the Pinelands Bulletin Board confirm his dedication to the medium. Formal presentation of the awards will take place during International Radio Days in Berlin in May and at the Association of North American Radio Clubs convention in Florida during July.
Rainer Lichter is one of Europe's foremost specialists when it comes to shortwave receivers and their design. He's well known as the technical editor of the magazine Radio Welt in Germany, and he's also written two books in the Receiver Chance or Choice series, published by Gilfer Shortwave in the United States. Rainer's been testing a new shortwave receiver from the Grundig Company of West Germany. It's called the Grundig Satellite 500. We won't see it in this part of Europe for a little while yet, so I asked Rainer for his impressions. Is the new receiver a sort of cosmetic upgrade of the Satellite 400 currently in the shops?
Grundig 500 is a completely new developed model, which means that the outsides and the insides are brand new, and there's absolutely no resemblance to the 400 type receiver.
And what sort of price are they aiming at? I mean, is this a hobby receiver, or is it something for somebody who's going on holiday?
Both. It is a receiver that is targeted at the more discriminating shortwave listener, but the features built in will also cater to the people that have higher demands on shortwave, that is the DX population. Grundig really has never catered to the DX people. Their receivers are solid, sturdy, reliable pieces of equipment, but not what we call very hot receivers. This one is.
The Satellite 500 offers two bandwidth filters, the narrow one being about right for listening under difficult conditions. The wide position is rather wide, so the signal has to be clear of side-channel interference if you select this one. The set offers standard AM, upper and lower sideband, and AM synchronized modes. Coverage is continuous from 148 kHz right up to 26 100 kHz on the European model. Plus, there's FM in stereo through headphones. But one of the clever points lies in the convenience of the memories.
Yes, what the receiver has, and this is something really ingenious. For one thing, it has 42 user-free memories, which you can program with the frequency and the mode, and you can also assign a four-character name to the station. You can put RNW or RNW1 if you have several frequencies of Radio Netherlands for the parallel-type frequencies.
And in addition to memory channels that you can program yourself, the Satellite 500, to be sold on the European market, will come complete with a database of frequencies already in the radio.
Grundig has put a read-only memory chip in there with 156 memories of, I think it is 40 networks. But it has about 7 or 8 frequencies for Deutsche Welle, 7 or 8 for BBC, 6 or 7 for Radio Netherlands. Of course, it has one only for minor stations like Radio Sofia, that's Bulgaria, and some others. But most larger networks have up to 7 or 8 of the most used frequencies in larger Europe. That is the important thing.
I see. So is the market then for this receiver mainly Europe?
Yes, the market is mainly Europe. Of course, there will be an international version, and now, you won't believe this, but the international version does not have this feature. Because if you set operate the set in the United States and dial the Deutsche Welle pre-programmed frequencies, you not receive them.
In the last 3 years, few European manufacturers have upgraded their shortwave portable line. Radios are certainly being sold with shortwave, especially to holiday makers, but most consumer electronic advertising campaigns concentrate on video recorders, hi-fi and television.
Yes, the Grundig really, the set comes as a surprise because no other manufacturer in Germany is presently doing really anything. If you look at other German names, they put out receivers which have, of course, shortwave facilities, but these are either manufactured in Taiwan or Japan, and they just get a German name. But what I am feeling is lacking within the last couple of years is sound receiver design coupled with modern microprocessor technology. As I see it, and I'm in the business now for more than 15 years, the tendency to put more and more conveniences into those receivers has led to computerized circuit boards that also have shortwave receiving facilities.
Yes.
This is for the portable market. I'm not talking now about companies like Kenwood and Yaesu and Japan Radio Corporation. Their receivers are all right.
Well, our tests here in Hilversum would certainly echo those sentiments. But back to the Satellite 500. It's going to cost about $440 US in Europe. That makes it quite competitive here, but very expensive for the North American market, where Japanese radios are up to 30% cheaper than on this side of the Atlantic.
Grundig informed me today that large volume selling will start by around the 20th or 25th of January. They had some sort of a production problem in Portugal, where the set is manufactured.
I see. Now, have they officially launched it yet?
Yes, it has been introduced to the main dealers in the second week of January.
Rainer Lichter's review of the receiver will appear in the German language Radio Welt next month, and we'll be looking at the set in closer detail when it appears here.
Well, Rainer also passed on another piece of news, this time concerning the Sony SW1S shortwave receiver. This sophisticated cigarette pack size radio appeared in April last year, but when you try to buy one, you get the radio, a large power supply, plus an active antenna unit and a plastic case without a handle, all of which rather defeats the appeal of the radio's small size. In Western Europe, for instance, the active antenna certainly is not needed for good reception. But until now, you've been forced to pay for all this extra stuff. Now Sony in the Federal Republic of Germany says that they will introduce the SW1E at the end of the month. It consists of an identical cigarette pack shortwave receiver, a set of stereo headphones, and a portable washing line type of wire antenna. The price is then $261, which means a reduction of 30% over the SW1S.
We checked with Sony outlets in the USA, Canada and Britain yesterday. They said they knew nothing about the SW1E, at least not yet.
Radio Denmark, in cooperation with the Danish Shortwave Club International, presents your DX window. According to the Radio Denmark Shortwave countdown, two more shows to go of the DX window, so welcome.
Remember that? Well, in the late 1960s, Radio Denmark's English service had a wide appeal, especially in Europe, and it was famous for its up-tempo programming. 20 years ago, though, the language services were dropped, and Radio Denmark continued as a Danish-only service for Danes living abroad. Last year, audibility problems and the ageing transmitter facilities prompted Radio Denmark to ask the government in Copenhagen to take over the finance of the shortwave service and also investigate the possibility of hiring airtime via Radio Norway International's new shortwave transmitters. An ultimatum a few weeks back seems to have had positive results, as Jorgen T. Madsen, head of the shortwave service of Denmark's Radio, now explains.
Denmark's Radio decided to discontinue the shortwave service on our own account. But shortly after, the government said that we could not do that. At the moment, we are continuing the shortwave service on Danmarks Radio's account. But during this year, the government will take over the funding of the transmitter costs. And the plan is that we should hire transmitter time in Norway. Next year, the government will take over the funding of the programs as well.
But will it move out of Denmark's Radio's building?
I don't think so, no. We will go on producing the programs, but the government will pay Denmark's Radio for doing it.
And when do you hope to start via Radio Norway's transmitters?
The transmitter time in Norway will be available from May this year. But I don't know yet if we can have finished the negotiations so we will be able to go on air from Norway as from May this year, because we haven't started the negotiations yet. Danmarks Radio is waiting for the government, and I think the government is waiting for Danmarks Radio.
Yes, I see. Well, finally, I remember listening to Radio Denmark back in the 60s when, of course, you had foreign language services as well. I guess the idea is to basically continue the service for Danish people abroad.
Yeah, that's the idea. But, of course, I hope that this new situation will enable us to take up foreign language programs as well on shortwave, probably in cooperation with the other Nordic countries. We have been talking with the Swedes about it, and they are still interested in some kind of cooperation with us. And I do not think that we will be able to take on that task on our own.
Media Quiz 1989.
Right, pens at the ready. Here are the details.
Last week, we told you of a strange clandestine transmission. For Media Quiz 1989, we've invented a spy station. Judging by the entries in so far, it shouldn't take you more than 10 minutes to crack the code. You'll need a piece of paper to play around with the alphabet to figure which letter is used to represent another. Right, here comes the final transmission.
Attention, attention, message. W, N, Z, Z, V, A, T. I repeat, W, N, Z, Z, V, AT. End of transmission.
Crack the code and you'll get one word. If you're right, you could win a copy of the 1989 World Radio TV Handbook. Your entry should contain your name and address, the solution to the quiz, and also tell us the number of years, if any, that you've been listening to international radio.
The address is Media Quiz 89, Radio Netherlands, P.O. Box 222, 1200 JG, Hilversum, the Netherlands. Your entry must be postmarked by next Monday.
And now for a complete change of subject. On May 26th this year, West Berlin will be the host of a radio convention. It's nothing to do with the European DX Council, it's more geared to programme listeners than people who want to search for weak stations. The agenda calls for several presentations on the future of international broadcasting, which will be illustrated by working exhibits. David Monson is the man behind what's called International Radio Days, and only this morning we linked up with him. Why did he choose Berlin?
Very good question, Jonathan. I think you only have to be in Berlin, as I am now, with the sight, the view, the vista, just beyond the International Congress Center, which is where I'm talking from right now, in the Funkturm, to realize why we've decided to use Berlin as a venue for this edition, the second edition of International Radio Days.
Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is... Ich bin ein Berliner.
The historic words of John F. Kennedy back in June 1963. Berlin is, of course, famous for its fashion, the wall dividing east and west, its orchestra, and, of course, the nightlife certainly livens up the place.
International Radio Days is for everybody who happens to be interested, whether peripherally or professionally, or even from a hobbyist point of view, interested in international radio, and certainly seeing international radio go forward into the next century. I mean, there's so many exciting things happening in international radio today, and we want this to be a forum for, among other things, the new technology.
Now, it's being held in Berlin. Does that mean that it's all going to be in German?
No, it'll be about 50-50. In fact, there's a very good proportion of the conference is going to be in German. And, of course, many of our speakers, the people that we have lined up, speak both German and English. So, really, communication, language needn't be a problem at all.
But if you're sitting through a German lecture, will there be a translation?
Yes, we hope to have a simultaneous translation of that lecture into English or vice versa, of course.
Hier ist Rias Berlin.
The historic importance of radio in the life of Berlin, for instance, is one of the subjects that's going to be given in German, and that'll be given by, of course, a German expert in the subject. The influence of international broadcasting in shaping attitudes and policies in post-war Europe.
So what about the prize?
The prize is going to be about as democratic as everything else, a very democratic prize for under 200 Deutsche Mark. 200 Deutsche Mark for a two-day package. It doesn't include the hotels, obviously, but we've even been democratic in the choice of selection of hotels. I've split the hotels up into four categories. I think it's 80, 100, 150, 200 marks. There's a lot of work, I can assure you, to be done before May the 26th this year. I'm beginning to sweat already, but there'll be plenty of time to dry out afterwards. I know at about that time, May this year, May into June, there are going to be a number of other abstractions and perhaps distractions in the shortwave, the international radio world. But I can, let me assure you again, and I can say in all confidence, that International Radio Days at the International Congress Center in Berlin is going to be the best.
A confident David Monson. We have a few of the application forms here at Radio Netherlands. If you're interested in the venture, just drop us a line and we'll make sure you get one. Applications have to be in by the 1st of March.
This is Media Network, covering the full spectrum of the world of radio in a form easy to digest.
Woo! Thank you.
Several listeners spotted that we haven't mentioned the average monthly sunspot number for a while. To put that right, our propagation specialist Mike Bird is on the line. So I guess, Mike, the number for December must be known by now.
That's right. The Sunspot Index Data Centre in Brussels tell us that the monthly average sunspot number for December was 179.4, which is up quite dramatically on November's figure of 125.6.
So you may say, who uses data like that, apart from curious shortwave listeners? What's more, when Mike talks about things like the A index or the solar flux, how is that measured? Dave Rosenthal recently paid a visit to the Space Environment Services Center in Boulder, Colorado, USA. That's where a lot of the data on the sun and the ionosphere is analyzed. As Dave reports, the SESC has become a world data center, collecting observations from similar institutions across the globe.
The whole idea of this worldwide network is to observe phenomena from the Earth's surface and out into space as far as your sensors will reach. By knowing what's happening in as much detail as possible, you might be able to predict what might happen next. To the users of the Space Environment Services Center's data, this can be pretty important information. To gain a perspective on the different kinds of phenomena being monitored, I spoke with SESC Chief Forecaster Joe Herman, and I asked him to describe the system of sensors involved in sending data to his facility.
We have sensors on spacecraft, for example. We have particle sensors, X-ray sensors, and magnetometers, which measure the magnetic field in the plasmas around the Earth. We also have sensors on the ground that look at the sun with optical telescopes. We have radio telescopes that look at the sun because the sun is a very strong radio transmitter. And we also have sensors that monitor conditions that are mimicked on the ground that happen in space. For example, the opacity of the ionosphere is measured by a rheometer. It's listening to stars on the ground and it can tell how disturbed the ionosphere is. We look at other sensors on the ground that measure the magnetic field variations. How disturbed is the magnetic field? And that's where your K value comes from. That's used, some people use for propagation measurements, is how disturbed the magnetic field. Well, you can do that by looking at the magnetic field as measured in magnetometers. The many, many stations send us data. We have over 1,000 data sets coming in here all the time. And we're trying to digest all that information to make some sense and make some predictions.
What about facilities elsewhere on the globe? How does the SESC fit into the worldwide picture?
We here at SESC in Boulder are the center for this hemisphere. We do the Western Hemisphere. But in addition to that, we are also the international center. So we receive information from the other centers, for example, in Australia and Japan. They send us information. We, in turn, use that information to make a global forecast and then send that information back out to everybody else.
The everybody else Joe is talking about includes not only the other regional warning centers like the IPS in Australia, the Hydromet service in Moscow, and the Meudon Observatory in Paris, but also a host of associate regional warning centers. These are in Eastern Europe, the Mideast, and Asia. Worldwide data users include superpowers like the U.S. and the Soviet Union to keep tabs on the environment their outer space hardware is flying through. But in addition to government and military users, there's no shortage of other operations who take advantage of this knowledge bonanza. For example, real-time and predicted space environment data is used by researchers in Sweden launching ionospheric sounding rockets. Then there are facilities in Chile studying ozone depletion over the Antarctic. And, of course, there are the radio users all over the world. This is everybody from the shortwave listener to the ham radio operator to the satellite communications industry. All people whose activities depend in large or small measure on the state of the Earth's ionosphere and the ability of radio frequency waves to propagate through it. Actually, radio propagation was the driving force behind the formation of the SESC back during its beginnings. So now, after two decades of operation, how pleased is Joe with the way this worldwide setup is working out? What kinds of things might make it work out better?
The SESC began in late 1960s. However, its roots or its predecessors go back to the early stages of World War II. The big concern was radio propagation for military purposes. How would you ever communicate with a ship at sea or communicate from the United States to Europe? And what was going to be the impact on military systems? Out of those original agencies, this center finally evolved, and in 1968, we became both the national and international center for doing this activity. At the same time, NASA was concerned about radiation because they were planning to go to the moon. Military people in this country were concerned for the same reasons they were before, but now we had spacecraft and there were effects on spacecraft. We're a joint center with the U.S. Air Force, and that works very well. And as a civilian agency, we can talk to the Soviets and every other country in the world and not have to worry about any political overtones, so we can exchange data very freely. Some of the limitations we have are due to budget considerations. For example, we don't have enough spacecraft sensors to monitor what's happening in space. Something will happen on the sun. 2 days later, it'll hit the Earth, maybe. And we have to decide whether that maybe is 50%, 20%, or 90%. And there's no measurements out there. We could put spacecraft out, but that costs money.
Missing information or not, the SESC has stacked up an impressive collection of Earth and space-based sensor data. The over 1,000 data sets Joe mentioned earlier refer to the more than 1,000 different measurements and groups of measurements constantly flowing into the center's data system. They come in from more than 100 different sources located on and above the planet. The interpretation of this data is no less impressive. Teams of scientists and computer scientists apply this information in almost an infinite number of ways to result in an ever-improving picture of the Earth-Sun environment. We probably have never known more about the relationships between this planet and its nearest star than we do right now. And speaking of right now, I was lucky enough to be in the Forecast Center when the geostationary GOES satellite sensors detected a sizable X-ray flare occurring on the Sun. It set off the center's event alarm.
What's going on? We got an M2 flare or bigger going on.
That trace right there.
This is a moderate-sized X-ray flare. Shortwave fades ought to be beginning on just about most daylight circuits.
So how long will it take till the fade begins? We just seen the
right
event.
Right now? It started right now. Notification of people, like the primary customers of the Air Force, is done at this level. There's another threshold.
The threshold Joe was just speaking about was the level of X-ray activity on the Sun, where two HF radio spectrum users, the Voice of America and Aeronautical Radio, have requested to be notified if the level is exceeded. That particular event set off a shortwave fade that lasted about 2 hours on the lower frequencies. In any case, the Space Environment Services Center is a fascinating place to be sure.
Thank you, Dave, for that report. And clearly, the increased solar activity is making the higher frequencies around 26 megahertz work well again. David Ward in Norwich, Eastern England, phoned us with a curious observation. He's been listening to the Citizens Band.
Well, last Saturday, I was very surprised. I was just scanning around about 26 megahertz, and most of the stations coming through were SSB, American stations mainly. And I found a carrier signal, so I turned around and eventually found it on narrowband FM on a frequency of 26.250 megahertz, and it appeared to be a relay of an American station, WTVN, in Columbus, Ohio. I'm convinced it was live because the time checks were accurate, the date was mentioned as Saturday, so it's all a bit strange.
WTVN Columbus News Time 12. Can I be one to talk? That story coming up on WTVN.
In fact, that's what's called a link transmitter. The disc jockey is out on location at a shopping mall, let's say, but the engineer back in the studio plays in all the music, commercials and news material. A link is therefore set up from the WTVN studio to the remote location, so the technician can tell the presenter through headphones when he's on the air and when a record is about to end, and so on. Stations in the United States can get a high-frequency license for this kind of thing. We phoned WTVN and asked engineer Gary Hartman what power they're using.
We are putting out about 100 watts at 100 feet height above average terrain. And what you're hearing is skip.
You get a lot of reports?
We get from Oahu. We've had one from Greenland.
Really?
Yeah.
31 minutes ago, we broadcast a strange series of tones. Maybe someone can figure out what it was by next week. Bye for now.